has not up title anymore, but...
Yes, yeah. We were still talking about the...
maybe we've exhausted.
Here we are, two hours later.
Well, I was going to say that this... telling you about Nicanor Alexander that had written... had made this tape recording about all the chiefs. And he said about Chickalusion, he said, if only we'd had money, Chickalusion could have done something with our village. And, of course, Chickalusion died before they got the money.
Mm-hmm.
But the first thing they built down there, which made me very happy to hear, was a community hall, and they call it Chief Chickalusion Hall.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it's good. And then a few years ago, about 5 or 6 years ago, I guess it was, they asked me to come down and see how the village had changed. Of course, I hadn't been down there for 25 years, I guess. So I flew down in their own Miss Tionic airplane. They had a private airplane.
Oh, they did?
Yes. Miss Tionic, so I got to fly down there. And Frank Brink was down there at the time. He was making making some kind of filmed. The people wanted to have kind of before and after, what their village looked like before all these changes.
Oh.
So he was making some kind of a documentary.
Oh, he could do it.
Oh, he did. He was so nice. He and his wife were down there. So they took us all over the village, and I got to meet a lot of the old-timers, people that were still there, still alive, and some of my old pupils.
Former students.
Yeah, my former students. And they showed me their beautiful new homes. Wall-to-wall carpets and everything, electric stoves, TVs, everything, you know.
Are the houses well insulated? That's the only thing I can
think. Well, this was the summer, so I don't know.
You didn't test it for you.
No, I guess they had kind of a hard time getting on to using all the electrical appliances, but they did bring a woman here from Anchorage down there, a home ec teacher, domestic science teacher, and gave classes so they could... to teach them how to use the electric stoves and the washing machines and things like that.
That's wonderful. You know, this has been the problem all over the world, where the technology of advanced civilization has gone in and said, now you must, here's this wonderful device.
Take advantage of it.
Yes, and then the people have no idea what in the world, it doesn't relate to their life. And out it goes, and then the people that gave it to them are so...
They say, well, they don't...
Yes, because they don't know how. Yes.
Well, at least they did...
So they brought someone to teach them how to use it.
And they were so proud of their new schoolhouse. They'd take me over their new schoolhouse. $750,000 schoolhouse that had everything. Auditorium. Just beautiful. They were so proud of it. And it kind of brought back memories of the old school that we had taught in. But they had everything. One of my former students, I got such a kick out of it. She said her little boy just couldn't get used to their new house, and every night he wanted to go back to the old house, the old cabin. So she said she finally took some dried fish and smeared it all around the baseboard of the new house, and the little boy was content then. The smell was right, so he didn't cry to go back to the old house. I thought that was a cute story.
By golly, that's...
Shows something, doesn't it? How important maybe the sense of smell is.
I read the other day, this is relevant, not historic, but relevant. This person said that normally the smell of bug killer stuff is obnoxious to people. But that as a child, his father had sprayed this on a farm where they spent a good deal of their time, and his happiest days were on this farm, and when his father used to spray, it meant they were there, and he was happy with his father.
It's the associations.
Yes, and he always loved the smell of that bug killer rodent pesticide.
Well, this little boy, he liked the smell of fish, and that new house didn't have it, and of course it permeated their old houses.
Of course.
Yes, I remember when they'd come to school, you could sure smell it on them. That's what they had for breakfast. Smoked fish and tea.
Well, I was up at Barrow, and Sadie Nailcook, who is
you
know?
I've read about her. She's a magistrate, isn't she?
Yeah, I love Sadie. Uh-huh. And she was telling me how they build a new house or something, and so that they had a separate place where they put their old meat. Mm-hmm. And normally they had it in the entryway, where they Eskimo people age their meat. And she said they'd always had the aging meat right in there. And now they had it in a new place, and they had lost, become unaccustomed to the smell of it. They didn't have it with them all the time. So now they could smell it. Uh-huh. Before they couldn't smell
before
it.
Before they couldn't smell it. It was
yes,
part
yes.
of their mm-hmm. atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they had lost that kind of olfactory fatigue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she said then she knew what the white people thought.
But they smelled.
Yeah.
Well, I got so I didn't mind it at all.
No.
I like the smell of it.
Yeah, the smell of sea lion.
Yeah. Well,
a fish.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've always, the earth smells. They have good associations to me.
And the wood smoke. I can't think of anything I'd rather more smell than wood smoke.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was where you practically had your honeymoon there at Tyone.
Well, no, we had lived for a little while in Seward before, and I met Cooper's Landing. Let's see, I was married in 34, I guess about 34, and it was 37 we went, because I had lived there in Seward for
3 years later.
Yeah, yeah. And then we came in here to Anchorage in 39, and we're here during the war years, and my husband went to work out at Fort Richardson. He was one of the first. In fact, I think he was number 13 or 14 to be hired to work out there on the building of the base, when they built the base.
Of course.
And we had had a little house. I mean, we were renting a little house on Fifth Avenue there, and in came all this influx of people. And the landlord, I guess, figured he'd get a lot more rent, so we had to get out of there. And luckily, my husband had an old friend from Cordova days that had a little shack on Fifth and East D, Denali, and he let us pitch a tent on the back of his lot, and we lived in a tent there. And that was in about 1940-41, and Carl built a shell around the tent, the walls and the roof, and when that was done, we just pulled the tent out the front door, and we had a little house, 16 by 20.
How about that?
And we lived in that and built onto it. We finally even built lifted it, put it up, and put a basement under it. We had quite a nice little house there. But everybody said, well, what do you want to move way out in the country for? It was on 5th and Denali. It was out in the country. But that's where we spent the war years.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. And Carl was working out there at Fort Rich.
That was Elmendorf at that time.
No,
not Fort
Richardson. I think it was Fort Richardson. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Fort Richardson.
I think Elmendorf and Fort Rich were the same. I didn't.
Perhaps they were the same.
At that time.
Uh-huh.
But it was Fort Richardson, but it was across what is now Elmendorf. Then they built a new Fort Richardson.
I don't remember because that must have been afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, I never forget those sirens. And I got so that I could never go to sleep until daylight, because the sirens would always be, just before dawn. And I'd lie awake waiting for it.
Oh, no.
Oh.
Is that right?
I would lie awake waiting for them. And as I say, you'd never know whether it was real or not.
Mm-hmm.
But I had the nicest little English lady neighbor. And I'd get very distraught, and I'd go over to see Mrs. Anderson, and she'd be, maybe she would be scrubbing her floor. She wasn't going to let the Japs find her with a dirty floor. And she'd sit me down and give me a cup of tea and quiet me down. Oh, Mrs. Anderson, she was a nice lady, Becky.
Well, there was a genuine fear here in Anchorage of the Japanese.
Yes, we never knew, especially after they'd hit Dutch Harbor, we thought we'd be next. And then came that Battle of Midway, which we knew they were on their way. And by that time, my daughter, oldest stepdaughter, had a little boy, and she and her mother-in-law was taking care of a little girl. So we took the kids and went up in the valley where they had a friend. And of course, the men couldn't come because they were frozen here on their job. But we took the children up there. We thought, well, if the Japs hit bombed us, well, at least we'd be safer up there with the children. So that was the war years.
Yes, and of course the communications were much more limited.
Oh, yes.
In those days, there was no teletype from, there were no telephones.
Mm-mm.
In fact, telephones have just recently gone in the last few years here. And they didn't have, they did not have teletype. And they had radio silence, so they couldn't mm-hmm. talk to one another from airport to airport or village to village.
Black
in the outlying areas.
Mm-hmm. And we had to have passports if we went outside. I think, yes, we had to have birth certificates anyway. Oh.
permission to travel, at least, from the government.
And to get into Seattle, we had to show, pretty sure he had to have birth certificate.
I believe that's right. I remember hearing that, too. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I never went out. In fact, for 25 years, after I came up here in 31, for 25 years, I never went out of Alaska.
Well, after you came here in 31, after you came back from going outside to school.
To school.
I see. Uh-huh. Sure.
Then it was in the 50s sometime before I went out again.
Yes, 56. That's
right. Yeah. Well, we stayed here in Anchorage until about 49 or 50. By that time, my daughter, one of the daughters, they were over in Cordova with the FAA, and I still had a brother and a sister over in Cordova. We decided we'd go back to Cordova. Mm-hmm. So then we went back to Cordova for 5 years.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
From 49 to 54
about
or so?
About 50 to 57.
I see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 56. My husband died then.
Oh, in Cordova?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And I'd had an interesting job over there. I had a radio program on KLAM. I had a woman-to-woman program. Got to meet everybody interesting at the town.
Isn't that fun?
I liked radio work.
Well, you reached, it was just to Cordova?
Yes.
About Cordova?
Yes, just woman to woman, you know,
running
like Ruth Briggs had here.
Yeah. Yes.
Gave recipes and household hints and interviews.
Isn't that fun?
It was fun.
I like radio work.
Wrote my own scripts and advertising and things like that.
Well, I wondered that
Chuck
station.
Chuck Buck was the owner of it.
I see. I was wondering about the history of that station over
Well,
there.
It started in about 52, 53 or 54, I think.
Is it still going?
Yes, but Chuck doesn't own it anymore. Don't remember who has it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that was
fun. That was a fun job. But then my husband got sick, and he died. And the next year was an interesting year, too. I was called on the jury. I still had an apartment house. We bought an apartment house in Cordova. And so I was kind of stuck there for a while. And I was called on the jury. It was the old territorial days. And it was a federal jury. So for a whole year I was on the jury. Traveling back and forth between Cordova and Anchorage because the court was held here. So finally it cost so much money. Oh, they had jurors from as far as Kodiak for this whole district, you know, Kenai, Cordova. But finally it got so expensive, I guess the judge just let us stay and gave us per diem. So I stayed most of the time here in Anchorage. By that time I had found a buyer for the apartment house in Cordova, so I got rid of that. And the next year, after that session was over, then I went outside for a while. My mother was sick, and they had meanwhile retired to McMinnville in Oregon. And I went to the Linfield College there to brush up. I thought I'd go back to teaching. Took some courses. Then came back up here to Anchorage. To Alaska. I couldn't stay away. I couldn't find anything outside I wanted, so I came back here. I went over to Kodiak, where my daughter, meanwhile, was with the FAA in Woody Island. So I went to visit her. And I got acquainted over in Kodiak with the people from the Baptist Mission that had a children's home. And one of the house mothers was ill, had to go outside for treatment, so they asked if I would substitute as a house mother in the Baptist home there, which I did for 5 months and just loved it. I enjoyed every minute of it. We had three cottages, and about 12 to 15 children in each house. And they had house parents had a man and wife, but the other ones just had house mothers, and those children were delightful. We had children from all over the islands, you know, and from down the Aleutian chain, and they were such cute children.
This was
I
before the earthquake.
Yes, this was back in 60.
Well, did you get
59.
Out to...
No, about 59.
Yeah, did you get out to Old Harbor at that time?
Not that time, no.
Did you get out before the earthquake to Old Harbor?
Yes.
Did you meet the woman? A fantastic story went with this woman. Her father had been a lighthouse keeper.
Uh-huh.
It seems to me now, let's see, was he the Swedish nobleman? No, that was the other people. Anyway, her father, I don't know, he was Swedish or something. Uh-huh. And he had taken a native wife. And something happened. I don't know. They were she was orphaned at any rate. No, no. Her parents were San Francisco or something, but they were completely Caucasian. But I think it was the lighthouse that was swept away in the tidal wave or something back in the
before the turn of the century. About it,
But she was somehow saved and sent into the orphanage on Woody Island. So that, but she was the only white child there.
Well, and there weren't any there when white
she was children. She was an infant when she was sent there. So she, a child, she grew up with the Aleut, they call them. Of course, they're Supik Eskimo or something, but they call them Aleut. The Koniags. So she grew up with the Koniags, and then the mission teacher promoted or arranged a marriage with a young, for this girl, with a young man from Old Harbor.
Oh.
You don't know this story?
No, I don't. Uh-huh.
So she went with him. They were married. And then on the night of their marriage, they took an open boat and rowed. And he rowed for 22 hours. It was a 22-hour trip by open boat to row that long. Along the open shoreline, that open sea, that coast of Kodiak.
Oh, good heavens. And so on streets?
No, it was on the outside. They would have gone out Chiniac Bay and out into the ocean, out into the Prince William Sound, and then followed along that south coast of Kodiak down to the passage between Sitkalitik, wasn't it, and Kodiak, and into that passage there where Old Harbor was on that Sitkalitik channel.
Oh my goodness.
And I think that was the name of the island, Sitkalitik, that was adjacent to Kodiak. And to Old Harbor, where she made her home. But these people at Old Harbor still lived in the ways of the old customs to quite an extent, and she told me about a trip she had made in a kayak. It was a two-hole bidarkie. It might have been a one-hole bidarkie, but I think it was a two-hole bidarkie. And she said she hadn't liked that very much because she had had to scoot down into the bow of the boat. And this was the way the women traveled, inside the boat, the dogs and the women. The men sat in the hole and tied their gut parkie around them, but the women...
Their camelacs.
The camelacs, yes, tied them around to make them waterproof, and they could roll over that way, and they were waterproof. But they, the freight went inside this skin boat. Women were freight, yes. And she'd had to make a trip inside that, and she didn't like being underneath the water and feeling the water go by her. And but she had accepted her life, and she had a bunch of grandchildren, and she was... I was there... When was that? About 59 or 60.
Really?
Yes, because my former husband, as a mining engineer, went out to Sitkanak. And we carried out some mining explorations on Sitkanak. But we had motor trouble. We had chartered an old fishing boat, the East Cape, owned by Sergei Pestrikov.
Pestrikov, yeah.
And he was from Old Harbor. And the boat, we had gone out in the midst of a terrible heavy storm. And that poor old boat, and in the middle of the night, I was so nervous, I couldn't sleep inside the cabin. So I had taken my sleeping bag out to the stern of the boat. And I was in my sleeping bag underneath in the shelter of a dory on the stern of his East Cape when I was awakened at 3 or 4 in the morning, and this was in June, I guess, or late May, it was May. And by a friend of ours, Tommy... what's the name of the family there?
Frost?
No, and his sister was a school teacher. They were part Aleut. Anyway, Tommy was skippering the boat, and Sergei had gone to sleep. And my husband, I guess he pulled his sleeping bag out to be under the shelter of this dory, too. But anyway, all of a sudden, Tommy started to swear, and there were loud explosion noises. And I raised my head, and I looked, and here were the lights of a village. And there was Old Harbor offshore, and the motor was just exploding like mad. And Tommy was shouting and for Sergei and swearing at the top of his lungs at the same time, shut this blankety-blank thing off. So Sergei got up and shut it off, and as it turned out, they had sheared off a part of the thing that makes the pump go. It wasn't a pin, but it was a shaft. She had a shaft. Well, we didn't know what it was at the time. And so they rigged up the bilge pump. And in the meantime, Sergei's brother in Old Harbor had gotten up. It was 3 or 4 in the morning. And he looked out the window and he saw, well, there's Sergei's boat out there. Little Sergei's down here from Kodiak. And then he thought, he'd just gotten up for no reason at all and was looking out the window. And this is one of those miracles, you know. Because a 70-mile-an-hour wind was blowing up on the other side of the island. And he thought, gee, there's something funny. Sergei is going backwards down. He's being blown down the channel. He must not have power up. So I thought, well, I'll go get my clothes on, and I'll tow Sergei in. So then he looked out, and he noticed that Sergei had steam up. Well, that was at the point they'd rigged up the bilge pump, and they got the motor running for a few minutes. So the guy thought, well, I'll go back to bed. I guess Sergei's all right after all. And he started to put his clothes back down or something. And then he looked out again and he saw again that Sergei was having trouble. Uh-huh. So then he did come out and he threw us a line because we kept getting up power and then we'd lose it. And the bilge pump didn't do the job in, on the circulating pump. And but the men said that if he hadn't towed us in, the wind was blowing us out to the channel and we'd have gone on the rocks out on the just around the corner. So he towed us in, and they worked all day long trying to get that boat going, and they couldn't. So finally, I said, well, I'm going to go ashore. They said they were going to run back up to Shearwater Cannery, and being May, the fishing season was about to open, but hadn't quite. But they thought that somebody would be by now at Shearwater to get things going for the season. So they would go up to Shearwater and get this whatever was wrong repaired. And as it turned out, they had to have a whole new shaft machine, but at that time they thought had no idea it was going to be so difficult. So I find that men tend to underestimate their problems sometimes. Multiply by 3 or 4 and you'll come up with how long or whatever.
How difficult.
Yes. But anyway, so I said, well, I'll take my sleeping bag up and stay somewhere up there. And they, Sergei said, well, go stay with the missionaries. So I went up and knocked on the missionaries' door. And Dave and Dottie Selden were the missionaries' names. They were Baptist missionaries. Well, I wound up there thinking I was going to be there a day at the most, maybe overnight, and the next morning they'd be back to pick me up. My goodness, they didn't even get into Shearwater until it was the night of the following day. It took them like 18 hours to cross a little narrow channel over to, I guess they had to, I don't know where they had to go. They had to go back up. Oh, the Shearwater was on the main part of the island. They had to go up outside and then across a couple of coves to get into another cove where the Shearwater was. And I didn't want to go back to that open water again. I was scared. So I went into the Seldens, and I was there 3 or 4 days. So it was during that period that I didn't get out and get acquainted in Old Harbor. It was cold and stormy, partly. But I did go over and talk to this old woman who was said to have been the only white woman
ever raised in.
But she was Aleut culturally. And that was
well, at one time, you know, the mission had been on Woody Island. That's where it was started by the American Baptists.
I see. So that Father Herman had started a mission home of sorts, an orphanage.
This maybe was on Spruce, but Woody Island had this Baptist home.
I see.
And the buildings burned down, and so then they rebuilt over in Kodiak.
Oh, I see. But that's that put me in mind. I couldn't help but tell you about that. She had been raised, and I guess it was a Baptist mission.
Woody Island. That's interesting. Benny Benson's sister was put over there too. No, it was Simeon Oliver's sister was put,
that's right.
Was put in the mission there, and I think she died there on Woody Island when they in the mission there.
I believe that is right.
Simeon Oliver's. Benny Benson, of course, was in the Jesse Lee.
Oh, in Seward,
Alaska.
Yes.
First in on Alaska, and then they brought them to, down to Seward.
Well, now, did you teach there?
In Seward?
In a Kodiak?
No. No, I was just a house mother.
For the Baptist Mission.
For 5 months. Until the woman got, the other house mother got well enough to come back. But it was fun. I enjoyed the children. And then I came back to Anchorage. Did some substitute teaching here, and then got into the library, where I worked for about a year and a half. Then I had a chance to go back to Woody Island for the FAA, and went back there and did office work.
You did?
I was there for 3 years on Woody Island.
Well, then you were there through the earthquake.
Yeah, we were on Woodya.
You were?
Yeah, it was, we were a lot better off than the people in town.
Why?
Well, our island was high. It was about 90 feet above the water.
Oh.
And although there was a little island right across, about 3/4 of a mile across, that the water washed over 3 times, just took everything out. But
what about Long Island, out on the forefront, the first island out there?
I think it was pretty well devastated, too.
I see.
Over there. But it was the tidal wave that did the trouble,
mm-hmm.
not the earthquake.
Hmm.
The earthquake didn't do too much damage over there because, well, here, these are two of the Woody Island children. We, on the other side of the island, see, the FAA station is on the far side of the island, but on the side near the Kodiak, here's Kodiak over here.
Mm-hmm.
We went over there next morning and we could see these great big buildings, boats
submerged.
Just going up and down the channel, yeah.
Mm.
Great big cannery buildings.
Mm.
Yes, it was a devastation. There are some of them, and some of the big boats were washed right up on the island. Yeah, here's, there was the second Russian church. One of the Orthodox churches to be built on Woody Island. It was torn down in 52. And it's a Russian Orthodox church on Woody Island. That was funny. It was the history of the, that was the bishop, I mean the
Baptist
mission there. And there is a group from the 1898. I wonder if that girl was
there. Oh, that's just what I was thinking
children
about.
Of the Kodiak mission in 1918.
Oh, that child mm-hmm. could have been in that 1898
well,
picture.
It could be in that first one.
Yeah, here.
Mm-hmm.
Like this might have been her
could
right
been
here.
Her. Mm-hmm.
That looks like she looked.
Mm-hmm.
I'll bet that's that child right
well,
there.
Yes, Ewell had all kinds of wonderful material. And all the old...
Well, you look at that. That's who it is. She looked like that
yeah,
at
sure could.
When I was there.
Could be a little white child, couldn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
50. Well, she could have been older than that because she was 70. It looks like her, though.
Uh-huh.
But when yeah. I met her, she was 70-something. Uh-huh. And when did I say I was there? 60.
Uh-huh.
Well,
yeah.
That could have been.
Could have been.
She could have been 65.
Yeah, she could have been 65. I'm just looking.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that resembles a woman I met. You know, people carry on their look, their
they
childhood.
Do.
Look into their adult years. Well, I heard a story there. I wonder if you ever heard this story. Was an earthquake story. And because, of course, it was, what, the Easter weekend, it was Good Friday?
Yes, uh-huh.
So the week before, this man had come from his cabin, and he lived out toward the bay where they hold the pageant play now. What is it?
Manuska.
Yeah, Manashka.
Manashka, yeah.
He lived out somewhere along, but right as he had a little cabin mm-hmm. off the road, down on the edge of the water.
Mm-hmm.
It was on a rock.
Uh-huh.
It was on a point overlooking the water. That was it. But anyway, he came into town and he hung one on. And so on Good Friday, because Easter was coming on, he let up his drinking and he went home to sober up. And he staggered home and collapsed. Well, the doctor had told him that if he didn't quit drinking, he was going to either have DTs or give up the ghost.
Mm-hmm.
And by golly, he passed out.
Woke up to the shaking.
No, he didn't wake up to the shaking. When he woke up, he walked out of his door, and his cabin was completely surrounded by water. And his little cabin, which had been on a rocky point,
uh-huh.
had submerged,
uh-huh.
so that everything had gone down, and the road had gone down underwater. Everything was underwater except his house, which was on a rocky point. It had dropped enough to his house was maybe just above the water line, but everything else was submerged. And he thought he had made this great transition to the great beyond, and this was his new abode, because it was
at
nothing.
At least it wasn't hot.
At least it wasn't hot, no. So, you know, he began to put things together that it really wasn't that much different. And he went back in, and he had to put on his hip boots.
Uh-huh.
And then he staggered in and found out what had happened.
He had a radio, huh?
No,
he didn't.
No, I guess he didn't.
Apparently,
because he had to, and there was no way to hitchhike, and it looked completely different. But because the road was washed out, so we had to hoof it.
Yeah, the roads were washed out, and we were pretty well isolated, and our boat was gone. We didn't, and our dock was gone, so we had kind of a hard time getting back and forth. But the funny thing was, there was only one grocery store left in Kodiak. the other is that crafts, right? Yeah, crafts had been
washed out,
demolished. Yes,
is that?
And it was one that kind of up on the hill, so it was awfully hard to get groceries. And so I sent out to Sears and Roebuck for some of this freeze dried that the explorers use, you know. And I got that by mail.
Really?
Well, very clever. I think it was very
practical.
I think it's quite something to say for our mail, post office.
Well, that's right.
Get food from Seattle by mail. Yeah.
Well, of course. Of course, Sears mail order business helped a lot.
Oh, yes. And they got the mail through. Taxi cabs would go out and get the mail from the airplanes. Of course, the airplanes could still land out.
I had never thought of there being a food shortage.
Yeah. Yes, they did, because our docks were gone. And we had to lighter out. Then we had to climb, we had to get into a little boat on the beach, or from the beach, and go out to a bigger boat that would be anchored out in the deeper water. Hmm. Then we'd have to climb from the little boat onto the big boat to get over to Kodiak, and then on the other side we'd have to do the same thing. We'd have to get off from the bigger boat into the little boat and then go ashore, because the docks were all gone.
Well, you know, where the channel was in the old days, they said, when I first went to Kodiak, the people told me, too bad I didn't have the tape recorder then. That was 1853. That was not within the living memory, actually, but there were people whose parents and grandparents had told them of the days when the ships would tie up between, Woody Island was the first island.
No, Long Island.
No. The first close to Kodiak, inside. What was it? Was it Spruce Island? Was the little island just the channel?
Yeah.
And where the docks were, that they, there were rings in the rock.
Oh.
Where the, did you not ever hear this?
I don't.
There were rings in the rock. You know where Baranoff's Castle, what they called Baranoff's
Erskine
Castle.
House,
the Erskine House.
Up on the hill.
And then below that there was a dock.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And the piers and stuff. Uh-huh. And that was all washed out.
And DNA, yeah, DNA.
And DNA was there.
Had the
well, underneath DNA and driven into the rock.
It was an old.
There were giant rings, and those rings were what the ships used to tie up to.
Neville, that they had a stone rock wharf that was under the Standard Oil Wall dock.
That's
the
what
dock
it
was washed away, and underneath it was still the old
stone
rock.
Wall.
Yes, and there's a picture of it in there.
Oh my!
Yeah. So they really built for a long time. Yeah, Yule has a picture of it in her book. Come help her when I want.
Did you know the Corneliuses?
I knew of them, yes. Yeah. Yeah, I knew of them.
Mary, as a painter, was a friend of mine.
Oh.
And Becca.
Yeah, here. Here is the Woody Island FAA station, you see. We were quite a ways below the water. Now, on this little island here, it was washed over three times, and everything was laid low, and there were some sea otter hunters, or some seal hunters, I should say, that were, nothing was ever found. No trace of them was ever found, but they knew that they were there. And here we are. This is how we'd go out to the bigger boats. Lighter. Yeah, that's how we would do it. And we would have to climb down the ladder.
Oh, yes, and of course, tides are pretty high. And someday you'll
have to get to those boats. Boats would be just bobbing up and down.
Oh, my.
Wow.
God.
Yeah.
Well, that's a beautiful book, isn't it?
Yes.
And you helped her edit this.
I did a little bit. Yes, I did some. Now, the first one that she and Amy wrote was called... See, I've got that here too. It was written before the earthquake. And, Kodiak Island. I did more work on this one. That was, she updated this after I left. But, this one was written before the earthquake. And I wrote this chapter. What they did was to get certain people to write different chapters, and you all edited it. I wrote this one, and then I wrote another one in here on the wildflowers. This one had a lot of pictures in it, because Amy, the co-author, was a photographer. He was a Navy photographer there. So this was, here was the old Baptist mission in Woody Island. I love that picture.
Which was an honest one. Sorry, I was looking at a Jacob
of
Lucknow
here. This, isn't that beautiful? I seen across Mirror Lake. Geez. And that was one of the dormitories that burned. Yeah, there's the eruption of Katmai, Beachcombe. And I think I wrote this one on the wildflowers. At least I rewrote it, edited it. So, they had some beautiful pictures in here.
Oh my, I'll say. Yeah, and what is this book?
This is called Kodiak Island. This is the one that Ewell and Amy wrote a camera report. Then she wrote the Kodiak's early history, Kodiak Today, and I edited, really rewrote that one, and rewrote this one.
Hmm.
But she does acknowledge.
Assisted by.
Yes. Phyllis Carlson and Mary McNaughton for rewriting and typing.
Oh, yeah.
But,
Phyllis, could we go back to your grandfather's letters? And you, when I came in this afternoon, some 6 hours ago or 3 hours ago, you had these papers out here.
Uh-huh.
And you were going to tell me about them. And so we kind of deferred it.
Yes, you said that you could have the...
have them duplicated, yeah. But perhaps you could tell me some of the things that are...
I thought she might be interested in this. Which is one of my treasures my aunt sent me. It's an appointment of my grandfather as a notary public and signed by John Brady, who was the governor at that time. In 18...
Secretary of State Albert Elliott?
1893. 1899. So they were there. Yeah. And then we were then a district, not a territory. We weren't even a territory at that time.
Isn't that interesting? You're appointing J.C. Downing,
uh-huh.
a notary public.
Hmm. Yes, and here my aunt said I enjoyed a look at Governor Brady's Irish mug in the last number of the Sportsman. Mm-hmm. I'd sent her the Sportsman. She said, when I was about 9, he and I were great friends. Another of the official characters I considered a Tillicum was Bishop Rowe, head of the Territorial Episcopal Church.
Did you ever meet Bishop Rowe?
No. If I did, I was very mm-hmm. young. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Because he used to come to Cordova, and I know he and my dad were friends.
Oh, you said you had been to Sidney Lawrence's funeral? Was that you?
No.
Oh, no, that was this afternoon when I was talking to...
Mr. Ziegler was a neighbor of ours in Cordova.
No, that's...
Eustace Ziegler.
You knew Eustace Ziegler?
Oh, yes, very well.
Oh.
Yeah, they lived right next door to us. He and his family. In fact, his two daughters, he had two daughters, Mary and Betty. Betty and Mary, yeah. They were used to... In fact, I have a good story on Betty, I think it was. She and my brother Jack were about the same age, and they were little kids, and Betty told Jack that she knew how to get to heaven. And of course, Jack thought, well, her dad was a minister. This is eat skunk cabbage. So they ate skunk cabbage, and they were pretty sick. They didn't go to heaven, fortunately. And I don't think Jack ever ate skunk cabbage anymore. But that was Betty Ziegler.
Well, was Eustace a minister?
He came up there as a kind of a lay worker. They had this Red Dragon, which was Episcopal mission during the construction years, you know, in Cordova. And in the weekdays, it was kind of a reading room, and they played cards. Then Sunday, they would let the altar down. They had it pulled up to the ceiling on some kind of rigging, and they'd let it down, and he'd hold the services. Well, he later was ordained. Bishop Rowe was the one that got him up there because Bishop Rowe was a good friend of his father, who was a minister, and his brothers were all ministers. But Eustace went up there not as a minister, as a lay worker. But he was ordained a minister there.
Well, he painted all over Alaska
mm-hmm. yes.
and did illustrations for publications in mm-hmm. Southeastern.
Oh, yes.
I thought that was his major...
No, he was minister there, the rector. Episcopal mm-hmm. director there for quite a few years, till about 1920, in the 20s. And he used to paint, of course, and his paintings were sold in the drugstore there. And I think it was Mr. Skinner, one of the owners of the Alaska Steamship Company, saw one of them in there and bought it. And Then Eustace Sigler got this offer from the people, the Alaska Steamship Company, to paint some murals and do some painting for them. And he said that Bishop Rowe, he was out with Bishop Rowe when they got the message, and Bishop Rowe told him to go ahead and go on. That was, he should do it, and he did. And that's when he left the church. Then he went to Seattle and went to painting.
I wonder when that would have been.
I've got it if you want it, because I wrote an article on it, and I got in touch with Mrs. Sigler, and she sent me all kinds of good material. She was living in Seattle at the time. I'll get it.
Would that have been about the 20s?
It was in the 20s.
That's the general period, the early 20s.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Oh, my. And then I met him one time, just briefly coming out of the Anchorage Hotel.
Well, you know, I hadn't seen him then until I went out to, for many years. And I was out in the, going to the University of Washington, and downtown, this man looked at me, and he knew me right away. He's got that, he had that painter's eye. I guess he never forgot.
Yes.
Me. He knew me right away. He hadn't seen me since I was a little kid. And he knew me right away. Hello, remember that, Mr. Sigler?
Oh, that's most interesting.
Yeah. And another artist that was there that later became Jules Dallagher. Did you remember Jules?
Yes, I never met him.
Yeah,
I liked his work.
He was there at the, I guess it was the early 20s too. He was there. Mm-hmm. He worked for the Times. He was, I think, a pressman first. He worked there.
Yes, one of the first paintings I saw of his was The Mountain Up and Back.
Mount Echoes. He used to paint
a lot of Mount Echoes.
Yeah.
Then he went on to Kodiak, too.
Then he, I think, landed down in Ketchikan. That's the latest I heard of him.
I see.
Was in Ketchikan. Hmm. Sidney Lawrence was in Cordova, too, at one time, too. I think it was before, but he was
before
there.
Your period of memory.
Yeah,
in Cordova.
I think it was during the construction when they were building the railroad.
Well, that, I didn't know that. Yeah. Well, that's real interesting to know about the people who came through there, and... Of course, Sigler, he left quite an imprint. You can't go into a bank in Alaska and they will have seen one of his paintings.
Yes,
next to the Lawrences, together hanging, that is.
Yes, Mary died just last year.
His wife?
Yeah, 2 years ago. Well, I was writing this article on him for the Alaskana, and I wrote to Mrs. Sigler for permission to use some material, and a picture I had, and also to get the dates and everything straight. And she was so nice, wrote to me and sent me a lot of material. So then 2 years ago, I was outside, I was doing a press women's convention, and we got together and had lunch, she and Betty and Ann and I, and my sister, older sister, and we all had lunch together. And we had such a good time talking over old times. And she just seemed so well, and so they still had a lot of Sigler's work in the Fry.
Mm-hmm.
Museum there, and she worked down there, I think, kind of maybe volunteer. And I was just so felt so bad to hear she died last, just this last winter.
Hmm.
She just looked fine. So Betty and Ann, they still live around Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. I didn't know a thing about his family's life story. Where did you publish that story, Anthony?
That was in Alaskana.
That's the newspaper, the Alaska Magazine.
This Petty John.
That's Petty John's
paper. Petty John.
That had some wonderful articles.
Uh-huh.
That some of the best Alaskan history has been in that, and I don't, we don't get it up in Fairbanks too much.
Don't.
Not like we should. We don't. It isn't distributed. I think you pick it up off the airplane if you fly Alaska Airlines.
Yeah, that's where he puts a lot of his.
Yeah, that's where I read most of it. What is that? Oh, this is his letter from your aunt.
Yeah, we got to talking about Bishop Rowe.
Yes.
And he was the one that that got Sigler up there.
Yes.
Then I read about Muldoon. And says, and she's talking about salmon. She says, makes me think of the kegs of salmon bellies everyone connected with Alaska had in their basements until the government put a check rein on the dreadful waste. The fishermen would just cut out the king salmon tummies and throw the rest of the fish back. An article in one of the magazines refers to the general public just fishing to catch and throwing the fish on the banks to rot. It reminds me of that same pastime the Sitka kids indulged in. We'd wade into the stream with spears, and the fish would be so thick on their way up the stream that it would be difficult to stand. We'd spear them as fast as we could heave them ashore. Too bad some adult didn't catch us at it. Another thing the Indian kids taught us to do was to go along the shore when the candlefish were being washed in, pick them up, and bite off their tails. It says young children are vicious little fiends without realizing it.
And throw the fish back in without its tail.
Oh, that's what that's what the native children taught them to do.
Isn't that funny?
Oh, dear.
See, I wonder if that business of the salmon is actually something that came about from the spawning of salmon.
I don't know.
Because I don't know of any fisherman who ever cut out the belly and threw the fish away.
I know. I never heard of it.
No.
But the salmon bellies, yeah. She said, I think it was the old Excelsior your grandfather had when Mom made the trip to Nome with him. Walt and I were left in Juneau in the hands of a nice Norwegian or Danish woman who ran a rooming house. I got too homesick to take it, so Mrs. Crockett, whose husband was on the old Walcott, which ran out of Juneau, took me in. The Walcott and Bear were sister ships. Remember the old Bear?
Mm-hmm.
She says, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they were still afloat because they were tough little vessels. Walter, that was my dad, remained with the Scandinavian woman and nearly drove her crazy. I remember a balloonist who appeared on the scene. Can you imagine? That was back in the 1900s. I suppose he was doing all the ports he could make, who had to walk back to town after he landed, and he'd walk about town collecting money in his hat. Of course, the entire population turned out to see the preparations and the takeoff. One day, a group of boys, your dad among them, were perched on the roof of a shed near enough that a dangling rope could be reached. As the balloon ascended, naturally, Walter, my dad, was the kid who reached it, and he went on up quite a few feet before letting go. Says the balloonist almost had heart failure. He just sat on a crossbar, no basket under him. When he got back to town, he tried to locate the boy who had scared the life out of him. That was my dad.
Isn't that funny?
Well, and she talks, I'd taken a trip down the Aleutians on the old mail boat expansion.
Oh, you did? The expensive.
Yeah, the expensive. And I'd written my aunt all about it. She said, your Aleutian trip sounds interesting. In 1907 was the last time I made it.
Holy mackerel.
On the way back, we took on a couple of cubs bound for a Detroit zoo. The man who owned a coal mine at Homer was taking them out home with him. I can't remember his name, but his daughter, about my age, was named Katinka. We used to go down in the hold and feed the bears honey. One day when I was too slow, one of the little wretches reached out and tore my skirt open from waist to hem. They were both dressed with heavy leather collars, and at Yakutat, your grandfather sent a sailor ashore with them to give a bit of exercise. One of them got away from him, even though the ship was held over for a search party to work at finding him. They weren't successful. I worried for a long time about his getting big enough to choke on that collar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then I told her about meeting this old man by the name of McGlashan, and think he was from Yakutat. He was a patriarch there. And she said, I suppose McGlashan remembered your grandfather Downing all right, but I'm sure that Pop was never navigating the Dora. You've heard of the Dora, the old mailboat Dora that made that trip, was gone, I think, for 50 days and finally landed down in Seattle, or down in the outside. But she says, I do remember that tough trip to which he referred, because Mrs. Landsberg was on it, either going to or coming from Chignik, where her husband was superintendent for the cannery there. She never did get through talking about that horrible experience. This old friend, this Landsberg, Mrs. Landsberg, the old friend was on that trip of the Dora that had that experience. She says, to the best of my memory, the ships that grandfather were, first the Excelsior, then the Ohio, then he went to the Philippines on the USAT Seward, and bought... Let's see, a few trips were made north before she was sent out as a supply ship around the Philippine Islands. And then my grandmother got typhoid. She went and took a trip with him, got typhoid, so they came back. She had to be taken to Shanghai and installed in a German hospital. Your grandfather got himself transferred back to the States as soon as he could. And then about 1903, I think, your grandfather was on the Bertha for 2 or 3 years. Then the Portland, finally a little freighter, the Genie. And then he got ill, and he was pilot for some of the boats. And then she sent me a picture. Said it was taken in July of 1907, one of the annual trips I used to make on the old steamship Portland. And she says another Elk Eye Pointer was on the return trip. She eventually, she was visiting an old timer who's. Husband was running the store at Elmar. She eventually married a son of Captain O'Brien, and he's a famous Captain Johnny O'Brien. You've heard of him, maybe? There's some books about him. He says he had either the Yucatan or the Alameda. As it happened, we had aboard a group from Boston, among them three or four young men, were people interested in the Reynolds Alaska Development Company at Latouche. Now, Mr. Reynolds is the one that organized the Valdez Home Railroad that I was telling you about.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and he had a group of Boston people on board. We had a high old time. Mr. Reynolds, if I remember, got in a lot of trouble later for fleecing Boston investors. He was a persuasive promoter. In Valdez, he organized a rally and raised $300,000 or $400,000 in a very short time. Sam Blum, who started with a small store in Juneau in the 90s, I remember, gave him $50,000. Reynolds chartered a ship to take a group over to the Latouche mine. Your father, by the way, was doing the assaying there. This was at Latouche he was assaying, not Alomar. And paid the expenses for the passengers, not concerned to wait in Valdez until the ship got back.
Did you ever get over to Latouche?
No, never did. Much to my dismay, your grandfather wouldn't let me stay, so I had wouldn't let me go, so I had to stay aboard. Well, anyway, I think
well, those are wonderful letters.
Picture, yeah.
That in particular, my, that gives a lot of.
You bet.
A lot of history.
It's history.
So anyway, Adele Smith told me about somebody that she had gone with who was a skipper. He really wasn't a ship captain, but she had made several trips with him in order to go to Valdez. She had to sail from Catella with him to Anchorage and then back to Valdez in order to go to Valdez to shop or something.
Uh-huh.
And but the boat would come into Anchorage first and then go back and let her off at Valdez. And she described this man. Apparently, he worked out of Catella, and I can't think Captain somebody. But she said he's one of those men that is one of the unsung heroes that is not well enough known that should have been written about.
Oh.
And this is like your grandfather here. You know what a book could have been written about his life.
Wish I knew more about him. Mr. Pettyjohn's always after me to write a story about.
Well,
Grandpa, but I just don't have enough information.
You don't have enough.
My aunt is dead, and my dad is dead, so I just
don't have any way to turn to it except unless it were direct research from the journals of the ships and this sort of thing. What were the pictures you had?
Oh, those pictures were the ones of the boats. Now this
yeah.
is an interesting. I can't make out what boats, but this is in Valdez Harbor, an old time as one my dad had. Must have been in the early 1900s.
Oh, this is real hard to
I can't make out what they are. And those other pictures I had, let's see, I think I showed you one was of the Portland and the other was of the Bertha. Oh, pictures.
This says something about unloading railway supplies and
yes, and doesn't it say Valdez?
Was something or other, 1,200 tons of, and I can't read it. Yeah, it is Valdez, September 1907, September 23rd,
maybe
-07.
Maybe that's when they were for the Home Railroad. Or it could have been, of course, for the Guggenheims, but I never could read what it said there. I think it's one of Haig's pictures, isn't it?
Well, I can't see the Haig on it.
I had several of Haig's. My dad had.
But it shows, two good-sized vessels here surrounded by a lot of little low boats with, what do you call it, housing over the dock.
Uh-huh.
And, gee whiz, that's a fascinating picture.
Yes, that is quite a historical one.
Well, if we had a magnifying glass, we could read that.
Yeah.
I left my reading glasses in there.
I just can't read it.
Well, why would you like to go and get a bite of dinner?
Oh, never.
Where shall we go? Shall we rewind the tapes and go eat?
Well, we could.
Yes, we could.
We could.